This is Digital Story Podcast number 586, May 30th, 2017. Today's theme is Wide Glass Will Save Your... I'm Derek Story. Clients can put you in the tightest spots, and I don't mean just with scheduling. Physically, I found myself with big shots to capture and virtually no room to record them in. Then there are the times where your arms aren't long enough, the steps aren't high enough, and the room just isn't deep enough. So how does one survive such tight squeezes? By going wide, my friend. And that's the focus for today's show. So when I'm walking around the world with camera in tow, I typically have a mid-range zoom with me. On the Pentax KP, I leave the 20 to 40 millimeter HD on there. Terrific lens. I absolutely love that lens. And that gives me a 30 to 60 millimeter range, effective focal length there. On the Olympus cameras, the Micro Four Thirds, I go with the 14 to 42 millimeter easy zoom. That's my standard walking around lens. And that gives me 28 to 84. Again, moderately wide, moderate telephoto. So those are terrific for everyday life, for just exploring the world casually and enjoying pictures along the way, right? But then when I have an assignment, any type of assignment, whether for hire by a client or I'm doing a favor for a friend, whatever it happens to be, I would never limit myself to just those standard zooms. Now, sometimes on these assignments, I do need a telephoto. And that's mainly for softening the background or doing portraits and stuff like that. That isn't the case most of the time when I have to wander away from my standard zoom. When I have to wander away from my standard zoom, the two lenses I just told you about, is when I have to go wide. And wide is the one that saves me time and time again. And it's funny. Whenever I talk to clients before an assignment or even a friend or however or whomever I'm shooting for, we go over details and there's a lot of logistics involved. And, you know, I try to ask as many questions as possible without driving them crazy, of course. But we never really get to the idea about space for photo shoots. And, you know, that's something that I have noticed over the years that clients have a really hard time with, just not really realizing how much space is needed for a typical shot. So let's say you're going to do a group shot of five people. Everyone thinks, well, five people, that's not very many people. You can just do that anywhere, right? You can do that in a 10 by 10 room with, you know, all sorts of clutter, right? No, you can't. Or if you can, it won't be the way that the person that's hiring you or asking you to do the favor, sees the shot. And this is the amazing thing that clients and non-photographers can do, which is when they look at a shot, they can just sort of wipe out everything that they don't want in the shot in their brain. And all they see is the five people in a perfectly clean environment. I used to have this happen all the time when people would scout locations for me. We want you to go shoot this old house or this landmark or whatever. And it's really wonderful. And I found the perfect angle and everything. And I would go out there and I would stand in the spot that they told me to. And I'd be looking at it and I'm going, well, what about all those phone wires and, you know, poles and all that stuff? It's like they didn't see them. It's like they literally did not see them. All they saw was the landmark or whatever they wanted from that angle. So I'm giving you all this background information for a reason, because when you show up with your camera bag and all your other gear, you have to be ready for all the stuff that they didn't tell you. Most of the time, the challenge will be dealing with space. And this is also on self-assignments too. For example, I just did a shoot for a client where they wanted an old truck. They wanted an old truck and they wanted to make a big print of it, and it was for a conference room. And it fit in with a theme that they had. And they wanted it to be in Sonoma County, all that kind of stuff. Looking all over the place for the perfect old truck. And I happened to find one. It was a really cool old Studebaker. But it was behind a chain link fence, not only on one side, but on two sides, with a lot of stuff in the background. And I'm going, okay. And this chain link fence, by the way, had barbed wire on the top of it. I mean, it was a serious chain link fence. It's not one that you just hop over and take the picture and then hop back. Plus, I had a feeling there was a dog somewhere. But anyway, the barbed wire was enough to keep me out for the moment. Although, I still have a few little scars from that shoot. But anyway, that was even without going over the fence. That was like hanging over it and all that kind of stuff. So I'm trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to shoot this thing? And the way that it worked out is that if I pulled my car up close to the fence and then stood on top of the car, it was a high fence, then I could sort of hang a little bit over the barbed wire and then use a very wide lens to get some shots from that angle. And then I found a little crack in the, you know, where the gate, you know, the chain, where the gate and the fence met. Well, the chain had a little bit of give in there, and I had a little working room where I could come in from another angle. But the fence was close to the truck, so I really needed a wide lens, because if I didn't have a wide lens for the shoot, then I would just get parts of the truck, not the whole truck. And they wanted the whole truck. So this wasn't even a situation where I was dealing with a client or a favor for a friend. This was an assignment where I just stumbled across this thing, and in order to solve the problem, I needed a very wide lens. I'll give you another instance. Using a wide lens really does help make your images look different than everyone else's. And you know, this is something that I love to say. We want our images to look different than the other guys, because if our images look different, and what I mean by different is better, right? Better. Because if we can make our images look better and different, then chances are we're going to continue to get assignments when maybe others don't. So I went on a shoot with another photographer, and we had to shoot an old historical building. And this was a lot of fun. I mean, I love doing this with other photographers. Same reason why I like our workshops so much. Because in that case, I get to go out with 5, 6, 7, 8 people, not just one other photographer. But either way, I like them all. It's fun to shoot with other photographers and watch how they, you know, solve the problems and approach the shoot. So this other photographer was working with a lens that didn't go any wider than 28 millimeters. And I was shooting on that shoot, I was shooting with a Pentax KP, and I had one of my favorite wide angle lenses. By the way, the next spot, I'm going to list my 5 favorite wide angle lenses. That'll be fun. But anyway, so the one that I was using for this, which is also on that list, is the Sigma 10 to 20 millimeter f3.5. And this lens is available in Canon, Nikon, Pentax, and Sony Alpha mounts. So this is and it's on sale right now, but we'll go into more into that later. Anyway, so I had, in addition to my normal glass, I had the 10 to 20 millimeter, which on the Pentax was a 15 millimeter at the widest end. And it was interesting, because what I would do then is I would try to find a unique angle in terms of up and down, and then use the very wide lens and then get close to the subject and then shoot it that way. My shots definitely looked different than the shots that were captured in the, let's say, the 28 to 60 millimeter zoom range, which would be the standard zoom for most of us. The shots looked very, very different. So then what we did was we mixed all the shots together and then just presented them to the client without saying there are two photographers or anything like that. I was doing a little bit of a test, not so much a test between me and the other photographer. The other photographer she's a great photographer. You know, she's fantastic. But I was really curious about this wide angle thing. I was testing this theory. You know, when I tell you at the end of the show I'm working on stuff for next week, actually, I really am. It's not just a thing I say at the end of the show. I'm actually really testing out ideas in the world. And this was one of the ideas that I was testing. So we put the whole thing together, the whole gallery of shots, sent it off to the client. And the client was reviewing them and reviewing them with a coworker. So it was the director of design and then the director of marketing, were making, you know, the decisions. After about a week, they came back, and the two shots that they picked were shots that I had done at the very widest setting on the Sigma, at the 10 millimeter setting, which was, as I said earlier, effectively 15 millimeters. And they were two shots that I thought were very good. I thought they were very good picks, actually, to tell you the truth. But I thought it was interesting because even though I had that very wide lens on the camera most of the time, probably about 70% of the time, I did switch lenses a few times, but most of the time I had that Sigma on there. Even with the Sigma, I wasn't always shooting at 10 millimeters. Sometimes I'd shoot at 15 or 20, depending on what the subject was and how the composition looked. But I thought it was interesting that, and these were going to be for big prints that hang on the wall in one of their branch offices. I thought it was interesting that the shots that they went with were the ones that were a little bit more dramatic, not an overly exaggerated perspective, but definitely something just a hair different, just not the straight shot. And that fascinated me. And I go, okay, that was a good test. Now, I have another kind of anecdote for you, and then we'll try to pull this all together. Well, actually, you don't have to do much of anything at all except listen to me, and then I'll try to pull it all together. Sometimes when I'm working with other photographers at workshops or whatever, and they're showing me their shots, and maybe they're getting ready for a presentation, or they're reviewing images on the back of their LCD, whatever it happens to be, a lot of photographers will take great pride in that everything is lined up and squared. So all the vertical lines are straight, all the horizontal lines are straight, everything is perfectly squared up in the shot. Now, obviously, there are shots where that is important, and it's also an accomplishment. And I definitely believe that. However, I also believe that you don't want to shoot that way all of the time. Because after a while, I don't want to say that it's boring. However, when you're showing the shots to someone else, you're not really showing them the world any differently than they're already seeing it. So when we look at the world, our brain and our eyes, you know, the whole system that we have, this wonderful optical nervous system, does a wonderful job of sort of squaring things up and balancing out exposure, all that kind of stuff. The world as we see it through our eyes is more or less squared up. At least that's the way we perceive it. So when we show them all the shots like that, we're really not showing people anything different. Whereas if you take, let's say, a very wide lens, and you change that perspective a little bit, and I don't mean go total fisheye on them, but I mean just play with that perspective a little bit, exaggerate the foreground a bit or something like that. And then everything else in the shot is still good, right? You still have good texture, you still have good exposure, you have great color or great black and white, whatever it happens to be. I think that when we do creative exaggeration or creative perspective, that creates a shot that's more interesting. And so taking pride in having everything squared up is great for certain shots sometimes, but it's not something that I think you want to do all the time. I don't think that should be your overriding goal for all of your architecture shots or all of anything that has horizontal and vertical lines, which is a lot of stuff. And that maybe putting a wider lens on there, having a little bit of play with perspective, can really jazz things up a bit. Having a very wide lens in my kit actually became one of the most important lenses in my kit. The last anecdote I'll tell you with this, and then we'll move on to some of the actual lenses themselves. And this has happened to me on workshops and where I talked with other people and it was happening to them. Let's say that you're in a setting. It's a great setting. You know mentally that you're in a good spot and that there are shots there, but you're looking around and you're just not feeling it. You just can't feel it. You're looking through the viewfinder and it looks okay. And you're just going, meh. You can't solve the problem. I usually do one of two things. One thing that I'll do sometimes is I'll find a place to sit down and I'll just take a load off and I'll just sit there and just take in the surroundings for a little bit. And a lot of times when I do that, then the shots will start to come to me. The other thing that I do is I will put a wide angle lens on the camera And then I'll go back and walk around the same pattern that I walked before and look at it with a very wide lens. And this is one of the reasons that I keep that Olympus 9mm body cap lens in my camera bag at all times. At all times, I have that lens in there. It takes up no room at all. I mean, literally, it's the size of an Oreo cookie. But yet, it gives me that 9mm perspective. Now, it's f8, so it's outside. It's an outside lens. But there have been times when I'm just walking around with my standard zoom. I cannot find a shot. I take a deep breath, and then I put that lens on there, and I walk back around again, and suddenly I find 5 or 6 shots, just like that. When you're stuck, a wide-angle lens can really help then, too. So those are my observations about how wide glass can save your bacon. All of those situations have played out for me, really, in the last month or so. I'm going to list some right now, and some are very affordable, and some are a bit more expensive, but something to keep in mind as you think about, A, how can I solve problems, and B, how can I bring more creativity to my photography? 5 wide lenses that have caught my eye. So I have a list here, and I own 2 of these lenses, one I want, one I had, and one I respect. So, respect in the sense that I respect it even though I don't have it, okay? So here we go. First one, the Venus Optics, and what is it, Laowa? L-A-O-W-A. Venus Optics Laowa 7.5mm f2 micro four thirds lens. Now, this one isn't out yet. This is due to be released in mid-June. The list price for it is $499. This is a super wide and a rectilinear lens, so it's not a fisheye lens. So it doesn't have the wild exaggeration that a fisheye would have in certain circumstances. And it's really sparked my curiosity because $499, f2, and not a fisheye, and it works on my Micro Four Thirds cameras. Oh my gosh, I feel like I could do some real damage with this lens. So I don't know if I'm going to be able to get it or not. I don't know if it's in the budget. I have a few other things that I'm budgeting for that are actually going to be part of upcoming podcasts. But I have my eye on this one, and if anyone in our listening audience gets one, please write me and let me know what you think, because I'm dying to find out. Okay, so that's on my list. The next one I do have, which is the Rokinon 7.5mm f3.5 ultra-wide-angle fisheye lens. I love this lens. It commonly sells for $299. I got mine on sale for $249, and it was a great investment. And even though this is a fisheye, technically, I tell you, when I use it and I keep the camera perpendicular to the subject, in other words, I keep those planes parallel to each other, the exaggeration is there, but it's not crazy. And then I've noticed that in Lightroom or Capture One Pro, I can even offset that a bit more, and suddenly I have a really wide shot that's really crisp and looks really good for a $299 lens that has f3.5. So not the fastest lens in the world, but I tell you, definitely fast enough for existing light photography. So I think this is a steal. And this lens comes in all sorts of different versions. For instance, I have the Micro Four Thirds version, but it's available for Sony, Canon, Nikon. I think you can get this lens for just about any camera. And it's terrific. And other people that I've talked to that have this lens think the same thing. And in fact, at the recent workshop, one of the participants told me that, you know, they changed over cameras and they had this lens in, you know, the other mount. And I think they switched to Sony and they went ahead and kept this lens because you could easily get an adapter for it. And it's a manual focus lens anyway. And that was like the one lens that made the transition from their previous system, Canon, I believe, over to the Sony system. That tells you something right there. Cool lens, like I said, $299. Quality is fantastic. And then I mentioned in the previous story, the Sigma 10-20mm f3.5 EXDC HSM autofocus zoom. That's on sale right now at B&H Photo for $449. By the way, links to all of these lenses are in the show notes, as you would suspect. It'll take you right there. And this optic is available Canon, Nikon, Pentax, and Sony Alpha. I have the Pentax version, and I absolutely love it. This lens has already saved my bacon 4 or 5 times, and I've only had it for a few months. And it's a great price, $449 for that quality of a zoom with a maximum aperture f3.5. That, to me, is a deal. Now, I have two very expensive lenses on here, and both of these I respect a lot. The Canon EF 16-35mm f2.8L Mark III USM lens. That's $1,999. So when I was shooting Canon for my commercial work, I had the Mark II version of this lens, and I absolutely loved it. 16-35mm on a full-frame camera, very sharp, just it lets all that light in at f2.8, quality image. It's really built ruggedly. It's a fantastic lens, and I had a hard time selling that lens. When it was time to let go of my Canon gear, that was one of the lenses that I had a hard time letting go. Actually, that one and the 17-40 f4, both of those were hard lenses for me to let go. And I think in part because of what I was talking about in the previous story is that each of those lenses, both the 16-35 and the 17-40, had saved my bacon so many times. You're going, oh, dear friend, you have been so good to me. It's hard to part ways. I mean, it was really like that. But I did. And if you do shoot Canon, I'll tell you, if you can't afford the version 3 for $2,000, the version 2 of the 16-35 is quite good. And then finally, Nikon shooters, they have a real treat also. The AFS Nikkor 14-24mm f2.8G ED lens. That's $1,896. Being able to go as wide as 14 millimeters with this quality top shelf zoom, I'll tell you, this can bail you out of a lot of situations. It's a beautiful lens. It's very well constructed. The ratings on it are very high. And if you're a Nikon shooter, you have the money and you can afford this zoom, I think you would really enjoy it. If you can't afford this particular zoom, though, remember that that Sigma 10-20mm and the Rokinon 7.5mm, those are also available in the Nikon mount. So you've got lots of options that range from $299 to $449 to, of course, close to $2,000. Five lenses that I respect and admire. And that Venus Optics, that 7.5mm f2, I've got to find a way to get my hands on it. Exposure even more important for video work. So I'm going to talk about the Sekonic Speedmaster right now that we've been talking about for the last couple weeks. And I've been focusing mainly on still photography, and I think part of that is because I focus mainly on still photography for my work. And using it for flash, using it for incident meter readings, all of these things that a handheld meter does so well. But another area where I believe that a meter like this is absolutely necessary if you're doing serious video work. If you've ever had to fix exposure on a video project, then you know exactly how painful that can be in post-production. It really pays to spend just another moment or two to really figure out your exposure and all that stuff up front. And that's what the Sekonic meter can do for you. It has full HD cine mode, and with it, you have the ability to measure from 1 to 1,000 frames per second or shutter angles of 1 to 358 degrees. I mean, this is a professional meter. Now, one feature that I really like with the Sekonic Speedmaster is that once you get everything plugged in there, once you know what your ISO is going to be and you have, you know, figured out your shutter angle, all that sort of stuff, then you can hold down the exposure reading button on this thing. And as you do it, you'll get a continuous readout as you move the meter around the scene. Now you really have a feel for what the boundaries of the scene are in terms of exposure. You can set an aperture, you know, if you want it a little bit wider and let those bright areas be really bright, let's say open window or whatever, or if you stop it down a bit, you're reining in the bright areas, but you're going to give up a little bit in the blacks. You can really evaluate that situation before you start the camera rolling. So in addition to all the other things that this light meter can do, having a light meter that has a full HD cine mode built into it is super helpful for your video projects and is what I consider the icing on the cake with this device. So if you shoot video seriously and you really want to cut down your post-production time so that you're focusing on the creative aspects of post-production and not just trying to fix things, I would say that is an excellent reason to take a look at the Sekonic Speedmaster L858DU handheld light meter. Now, if you want to learn more about it, I have a link in the show notes, and we have a tile on all the pages of the digital story. This is a high-quality instrument that can help you with both your still photography and your video photography. Red River Paper's new Palo Duro etching paper aims to recreate look and feel of fine art darkroom prints. And this is via imagingresource.com. Our good friends over at Red River Paper have introduced a new paper, and I'm going to tell you about it right now. I'm just going to go ahead and read what Imaging Resource wrote. Texas-based Red River Paper recently announced a new fine art paper, Palo Duro etching. The new paper is 100% cotton rag paper and is free of optical brightener additives. The paper is designed to offer warm white tones, deep blacks, and subtle texture to accurately recreate traditional darkroom fine art prints. Red River Paper owner Drew Hendricks says of the new paper, and I'm not sure Drew is the owner. I'm just reading text here. I work with Drew. I don't think he owns Red River Paper, but I think he is definitely the top banana. Anyway, here's what Drew has to say. Our new Palo Duro etching paper is one of the finest photo papers we have ever produced. From its subtle textured surface and quality feel to rendering warm, natural tones in deep, rich blacks, Palo Duro etching will satisfy even the most critical eye. The museum-grade paper is produced to deliver high quality over a long period of time thanks to its acid-free base stock and coating. Further, the paper has a thickness of 21 mil and a weight of 350 GSM. So this is pretty nice stuff. It's going to be available in 4x6, 5x7, 8x10, 8.5x11, 9x13, 11x14, 13x19, 17x22, 17x25, and 13 by 38 inches, and 50-foot rolls will be available also. So, and in 17, 24, and 44-inch widths. So I have a box ordered, and I'm waiting for it to get here, and I'm definitely going to give it a spin, and I'll probably follow up on Facebook and Twitter and let you know how it goes. But this is all part of that thing that I've been talking about where we can shoot film or digital, and then instead of having to go into the dark room to process the film, you know, we can have it lab and scanned, or our digital stuff, we can apply a film like filters to it. And then instead of having to go to the dark room to make the prints, we can use this type of paper, these paper surfaces that are available through our inkjet printer to create something that is really special looking. Like I said, this looks like beautiful paper stock. I can't wait to try it. Just a couple updates here. First of all, big thanks to our Patreon members for helping us keep the lights on, for helping me run this podcast like the predictable professional business that I want it to be and that I think you want it to be also. Patreon members are set up to donate monthly. It all happens automatically. Most of our Patreon members are donating $5 a month towards supporting not only this podcast, but the whole digital story platform. We thank you very much because that money is part of our budget now, and that money helps keep the lights on here, not only for you guys, but for everyone else. And there's a tile on all the pages of the digital story if you want to learn more about Patreon and supporting this podcast. Also, just want to mention that we have a couple seats open for our Autumn and Wine Country Photography Workshop. That's coming up in late October. This is going to be a very special event. If you're interested, go over to the workshops page on the Digital Story. There's up in the top nav bar there, you'll see workshops. Click on that and you can learn about this terrific workshop. And last but not least, I want to thank again our friends at Red River Paper. I'm working very closely with them right now. The ebook on creative printing is coming along great. Everyone who attends my talks at Out of Chicago is going to get a free copy of this ebook. That's when we're going to debut it. And we're also working with Red River Paper for other ways to get this out there. I tell you, every time I write a chapter and think of something new to do with their different paper stocks, I just fall in love with printing all over again. Big thanks to Red River Paper for not only supporting this podcast, but keeping me enthused about the art of making prints. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. I have totally enjoyed working on these stories for you. As I mentioned earlier, I have more stuff in the hopper. Come back next week and join me. Until then, go take some beautiful pictures and meet me back next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.